Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoppe. We're talking about cardiovascular prevention. Today's guest, Dr. Thomas Williams, and you can find stuff that he's written on this subject in relationship to some concerns he has about red yeast rice at Point Institute, or is it thepointinstitute.org?
It's just pointinstitute.org.
Okay.
Pointinstitute.org.
Great. And so what does work? What are some of the things that work in a more safe and reliable fashion to lower cholesterol?
So if you start looking at the gamut of things that we would say are non-pharmacological agents, so that we're just going to kind of shift over, we're not going to go into the pharmaceuticals. But niacin sort of fits into this weird category. It actually is a drug. If you make a claim that it's a drug, meaning if you sell niacin and you say that it lowers LDL cholesterol or has an effect on cholesterol, that makes it a drug. But because it's also a vitamin, it can be sold as long as you're not making a claim. And I don't know that we want to spend time getting into the nuances other than to say that most of this, quote, negative studies on niacin that have come out recently in the last 5 years or so that have told us niacin doesn't work, people need to understand that that's niacin added to statins. And what they're trying to do is say, can we, after giving them statins, and a lot of these people are on aspirin, like you mentioned, and other drugs as well, if we give them niacin, can we, you know, give them a slightly less risk than they would have had they not had all these other drugs? And it turns out that it's very hard to sort of squeak out an extra statistical percentage point here or there by giving somebody niacin. So niacin on its own, in the absence of statin, is still a very powerful drug or supplement, however you want to term it, for reducing LDL. One of the few things that raises HDL very well and has a dramatic effect on lowering triglycerides. So it has an effect on all three where we don't see that typically with statins. And interestingly, while we don't have time to get into LP little a, which is a modified LDL particle that has high atherogenic potential, niacin is one of the few things that we know that does it is able to bring that down. So we don't want, I don't want to lose that in the discussion, although I don't want to talk that much about niacin, but we should remember that it also is a dietary supplement as long as not making claims about it.
Any comments on crystalline versus time release niacin? Because there are all these different variations. And there's the no flush niacin, the niacin hexinositol, which in my opinion doesn't work. Worth a darn.
So if you look, so if you look at niacin, if you what we call crystalline niacin or just straight niacin, it's the part that, you know, you take niacin, it causes your ears to get red, the flushing effect. As it turns out, the flushing effect is actually a sign that it's probably working very well. And actually people who use who can handle the flushing effect of niacin will actually get a better benefit on most of its benefits, especially raising HDL and some other effects on triglyceride lowering. But the time-release form obviously slows that process down, and so it allows for you to take the niacin at doses that don't cause as much flushing. And they actually temper the benefit a little bit, but there's still, you know, it doesn't temper it that much. So you can still get the benefit with the time-release forms. And so, like you mentioned, the inositol hexaniacinate will not work. It doesn't release niacin at all, and it's actually been tested in clinical literature for that. So we don't. That used to be what, when I first, you know, 20 years ago, that was the flush-free niacin that everybody's using. Turns out it's not effective, and nor is niacinamide. You really need niacin or nicotinic acid, which is going to be the active form.
Okay. Other things that have been proposed, polycosanol enjoyed popularity for a while. What's your take on that?
Polycosanols, we don't need to spend too much time. These were studies done on this aliphatic set of alcohols that were mostly taken from sugarcane. Turns out most of the studies in the late 90s, early 2000s were all performed in Cuba, where the sugarcane polycosanols were produced. A series of articles came out in the mid-2000s that basically showed that you know, it didn't work at any level in sort of non-Cuban subjects, and we're not sure exactly what was going on in Cuba. You know, a lot of suspicion that that data was not legitimate. So that's pretty much been, I think, debunked as far as an active ingredient. And, you know, so, you know, we kind of done away with that. Garlic is one that I tell people, there's, you know, I don't know how many studies there have been on garlic with some sort of lipid-related outcome or heart disease-related outcome, probably 50 or more. Some of these are fairly well studied. What I tell people is that the benefit of garlic probably it goes much beyond its ability to alter your lipids, although there is some modest lipid-lowering effects on certain garlic-type products. But I think what it does to the endothelial function, to inflammation, to other aspects of the cardiovascular sort of network is probably more effective than its effect on lipids. And so I always tell, maybe not from a supplement standpoint, but from a dietary standpoint, to consume as much garlic as, you know, you and your close friends will allow. You know, I really like the whole idea of the garlic. I just don't think its lipid-lowering effects are its major component.
Okay. Pantothene is another one that's been promoted.
Yeah, pantothene, we've looked at pantothene, and interestingly, pantothene, spelled I-N-E at the end, is a dimer of pantothene, spelled E-I-N-E at the end. The reason I say that is because pantothenic acid, which is what we think of as vitamin B5, which can become acetyl-CoA and go into that whole pathway, is not how it works. It actually breaks down into something called cysteamine, which actually can modify the effect of lipids. So if you look at the data on pantothene, it's really more effective at lowering triglycerides and probably has more of an effect on fatty liver disease than it does on cardiovascular outcomes. Most of the data on pantothene is in Japan, so we don't have a lot of Western subject studies on that, but it's something to keep in mind, especially when you have fatty liver disease and high triglycerides.
Okay, before we get to things that work, that you can get behind, let's allow for a brief pause to hear a word from one of our sponsors.
This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Zona Plus, an effective non-drug treatment for high blood pressure. It's a safe, easy way to lower your blood pressure naturally, and it's so effective it works for 9 in 10 people. The Zona Plus is a high-tech smart device that guides you through a patented therapy that's personalized to your unique physiology. To find out more, go to tryzona.com or call toll-free 888-408-6141. As a listener to Intelligent Medicine, you can get $50 off and free shipping. Just use the coupon code Hoffman at checkout at tryzona.com.
Thanks very much for listening. And now back to our discussion with Dr. Tom Williams about things to help reduce cardiovascular risk. So, okay, we ran down some products that you're not that enthused about in terms of their ability to reduce risk and lower cholesterol. What are you up on these days? What are some of the things that you're working
on? I'd say the two new kids on the block, I mean, I don't know how new they are as far as they've been around for thousands of years, but they both start with a B, berberine, and something called bergamot. Mm-hmm. Berberine is an alkaloid ingredient that we've been using for, you know, years and years, and of course traditional Chinese medicine has been using it for decades. And more recently has been discovered to have sort of not only lipid but also glucose modifying effects in initially Chinese subjects. And so this is being studied in a number of different ways, lowering LDL cholesterol, lowering triglycerides, lowering total cholesterol, and then modifying and reducing glucose and glycated hemoglobin, sort of all these sort of things. And it appears to be a really great substance for modulating what we might call the cardiometabolic risk profile, because there's some anti-inflammatory benefits, obviously metabolic benefits, and then some of the biomarkers that we like to see change are are moving in the right direction. Interestingly, berberine modifies the microbiome, which we now know in a positive way. People have always been concerned about berberine sort of being negative in its ability to affect bacteria, thinking it's an antibiotic, and so maybe we shouldn't use it. But as it turns out, when you look at what happens before and after you use berberine, you modify the microbiome in a positive way, metabolically positive way. Actually, similarly, they're actually looking at metformin as being a microbiome modulator. Berberine modulates it.
Yeah, people know when they take metformin that they get gastrointestinal side effects, which may be a partial key to its action by modifying the microbiome that actually can change metabolism and insulin handling.
Exactly. And so the microbiome changes probably many compounds that we don't know, but berberine in particular. Ironically, berberine also is modified by the microbiome, meaning certain people, and they've actually done studies showing that in some ethnicities, based on where they live in the world, they have a different bioavailability of berberine and different metabolites of berberine because of the microbiome's ability to modify it to make it more or less bioavailable. So it's kind of an exciting area, and I think a lot of clinicians and a lot of patients already know about berberine and are using it, usually in 1,000 milligram per day kind of range is where that's been. But the other one, which I would even consider maybe even a more new kid on the block as far as its research goes, is bergamot. And this is a citrus plant, a citrus fruit, I should say. It's a tree, but it's a citrus a fruit that comes from Calabria region, which is sort of the toe of the boot of Italy. In just, I'd say, the last 10 years, there's been just a number of different papers coming out looking at both the essential oils, which are sort of used in perfumes and other confectionery-type uses, and the essential oils are being looked at for stress and some other effects. But then there's the juice component, or the part that has a lot of these polyphenols, a lot of the flavonoid components, and those have been recently studied for a number of wide range of metabolic effects, including their effects on these parameters that we're talking about, so LDL cholesterol lowering, triglyceride lowering, some HDL increases, and then even more broadly looking at lowering inflammation. I know you've looked into quite a few of these things yourself, so you realize that when we start looking at these parameters, you know, we're starting to see, you know, inflammatory markers changing, maybe fibrinolytic markers changing. We're starting to see, of course, the lipid markers changing, and there's even some data that suggests that there's even some blood glucose management or modulation with these polyphenols that we get from bergamot. So it tells us, like berberine in some ways, that and we know from the mechanistic studies that it's modulating some of the inner mechanisms of the cells that are kind of key modulators of all these features, which is kind of what we want to go with, rather than just using something like a statin, which just, you know, blocks one pathway. We want to use some of these natural ingredients that appear to be modulating what we call pleomorphic effects, you know, modulating a number of different effects, all of which seem to be helping sort of the cardiometabolic risk profile.
Yeah, I did a little research on bergamot for an article that I wrote a couple of weeks ago for our newsletter, which appears at drhoffman.com. And, you know, there's so much information on it. And as you say, there are what are called pleiotropic effects, which are another way of saying off-target effects. Yeah, it's a cholesterol-lowering effect, but there are also other off-target effects which may be beneficial, blood thinning and endothelial protection, anti-inflammatory, antioxidant effects, and so on. But one of the effects that I saw in some papers was that it was an HMG-CoA receptor blocker, which is technically the same mechanism as statins and red yeast rice. First of all, am I correct in saying that, or is that just a weak effect? But if it were to be the case, then bergamot might have some of the same side effects of statins. It would also call for supplementing coenzyme Q10 with it, because when you block HMG-CoA, you block the synthesis of CoQ10.
Right. So, you know, this is the difficulty in figuring out sort of the mechanisms. We get ingredients like this. We find an outcome either in animals or humans, And then we start looking at the possible things. And those are the first things people look at. If it's modulating cholesterol, they do what we call in vitro studies, where you're not in a human or an animal sometimes, but you're looking at cells or even just enzymes and test tubes. And at that level, we know that some of the polyphenols, bergamot, have an effect on HMG-CoA reductase. That's the enzyme that converts to cholesterol, making the mevalonate intermediate. And so with that in mind, we would say, what percentage of the benefit you're seeing in an individual or an animal is that particular component, the HMG-CoA reductase inhibition? And we just don't know. So when you look, so we know we have all these other mechanisms going on as well. So the question becomes, how much of that benefit is being derived from that particular mechanism? And when you look in the clinical studies, you say, okay, do we see liver enzyme effects with the use of bergamot? And the answer is no. In fact, same thing with berberine. They look the same thing. Do you see the liver enzymes? Do you see CoQ10 depletion? The answer has been so far no. So. Does that mean that there's other mechanisms going on that are probably overpowering it or causing that effect not to occur? Probably. It's probably because there's multiple effects going on that we're not seeing that one overwhelmingly strong effect on, you know, what we would see as a statin-like side effects.
Well, what got my attention with bergamot is, you know, first I've known about bergamot for several years, but it was on my radar screen, but I'm not an early adopter of brand new things. I want to see if they really work, if they are safe, if the science continues to be robust, and I also want to gain some clinical experience before I make a broad recommendation. But I decided to acid test the bergamot on one of my most challenging patients, a patient who has what you referred to in part one as a familial hyperlipidemia, which is not run-of-the-mill high cholesterol. You know, maybe your cholesterol is 270 or 300. This person runs cholesterols in the 500s and 600s and has cholesterol deposits on her skin. It's a very usual syndrome. And so she's on the maximal dose of statins and on 80 milligrams of Lipitor, got her cholesterol down to 417, which is pretty lousy. And so I said, well, you know, let's give her a couple of bergamot pills, actually the product that's made by Orthomolecular. I think it's called, what is it, Bergamot BPF?
BPF.
Okay.
And, yes. BPF.
And we did it for a month. She felt fine. We repeated her numbers. It went from 417 to 327, which is a remarkable response to a nutritional supplement in someone who has rip-roaring high cholesterol. And I thought that was interesting because not only did it demonstrate that bergamot could lower cholesterol, but that it could be a safe and effective add-on to statins and complementary. Has your research borne that out? Is that people on statins can get an added benefit?
Yeah, so if you look at the research, obviously in many cases, it's virtually impossible to do studies in patients that have elevated cholesterol or risk without also them being on a statin. So it's becoming harder and harder to do sort of,
ethical
you know,
purposes.
Studies on an ingredient by themselves, but in the case of bergamot, the Italian group that has been researching this has been doing add-on, either comparative studies where some of the group is on statin, some of the group is on bergamot, and then they've added additions, and they found indeed that when you add bergamot to a statin therapy, that you increase the benefit of that. So it's not surprising. And in this case, when you find someone with a sort of a familiar genetic propensity to produce more cholesterol and not modify it properly, you know, an ingredient like bergamot potentially might be triggering a metabolic pathway that, you know, statins just can't effect.
Yep.
And so that's why sometimes you get this sort of synergy that you wouldn't maybe expect in all cases, and tells us that probably other mechanisms other than HMG-CoA reductase inhibition is going on, because 80 milligrams of Lipitor, as is hitting it with a pretty good hammer.
Yeah.
So
it's
probably affecting by other mechanism.
It's going to shut that pathway right down. So whatever additional reduction you're getting is probably through other pathways or mechanisms. Okay, so let's round out our cardiovascular protective regimen What are some other things that we might consider using, even if they don't significantly impact cholesterol?
Well, I mean, I think we shouldn't forget, you know, obviously we've sort of moved on from diet and exercise, assuming that people have that sort of foundation. Fiber, if you look at the fiber components, both soluble and insoluble fiber, for years we've known that they have a modest effect on the ability to lower cholesterol. People with higher fiber in their diet, fiber supplementation also is able to reduce all the lipids, probably from an absorption standpoint. And probably, maybe more so now than we've ever thought, is by modifying the microbiome again. So we know that fiber it can act as a prebiotic or a modulator and a feeder of certain parts of the good bacteria in the gut. And so likely by changing bowel transit time and also by feeding good bacteria, fiber is one of those components. Along with that, if fiber binds to bile, of course, you know, there's a drug out there called styrene and others that are just bile sequestering agents. And if you bind bile, which is obviously produced by by the precursors, cholesterol, if you bind that, and of course it goes out with everything else in the toilet, then the liver has to then produce more bile. So we see things like artichoke extract, which is what's called a bile stimulator or a choleretic and a cholagogue. Artichoke, maybe silymarin, but actually there's research on artichoke extracts being able to stimulate bile, and you combine that with fiber, and of course that would produce more bile, trap more bile, and move more bile out. It's not a mechanism that's going to drop, you know, the levels, you know, 50%, but there's data to suggest that if you consistently take fiber in the diet, you're going to see a long-term effect on reducing cholesterol and other biomarkers related to glycemic control and these kind of things. The list is quite long if you get over into things that affect the metabolic side of glucose, some of which have a modulating effect on cholesterol, things like lipoic acid and cinnamon and chromium, but none of them have really had, you know, large clinical trials looking at endpoints related to lipid lowering and cardiovascular endpoints. So it'd be a little hard to go beyond that. One that some of your viewers or listeners may hear of is Google lipids.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Google sterones, which come from the Google lipid, and these were used in India, the Ayurvedic medicine, for a long time. You know, and probably what I tell people is probably within the Ayurvedic model, I think it probably has a more cogent use, meaning you use it with the diagnostic and therapeutic uses within Ayurvedic medicine. When it was used as a standalone ingredient in sort of a Western clinical trial where they measured LDL cholesterol, gave a product, gave placebo, it had modest effects which were not statistically significant. So I tell people as a standalone ingredient, it probably is not sort of the go-to place to go. Sometimes it can be added to other things and it might be somewhat helpful, but statistically it's not one of those powerful ingredients that we use today.
Mm-hmm. Then, of course, fish oil, magnesium, these are things that may have benefits apart
right.
from cholesterol lowering.
Right.
There's a lot going on there.
Well, I should mention fish oil. In the case of fish oil, if we're just talking about, let's say, the higher dose fish oil products, it reduces triglycerides. It does not reduce cholesterol per se. And so what I tell clinicians is that you will often see a compensatory rise, a very small but maybe clinically significant rise in LDL cholesterol and HDL cholesterol, by the way, when you give fish oil, especially if you combine fish oil with things like a low-carb diet so that you're really reducing triglycerides. When you do that, it causes a shift of the cholesterol that was sort of taken up by what we call the VLDL, which is the very low density lipoproteins, mm-hmm. and it shuttles back cholesterol to the LDL and the HDL particles. So this actually is a good thing, meaning it's modifying and creating better particles. But if you're only fixated on that LDL cholesterol number and it goes up, you know, a lot of clinicians are worried, a lot of patients are worried, but it really tells you that you're getting a better profile. That's why I often recommend, you know, some of these larger panels that look at LDL particle size or particle number, and then it'll kind of give you more information about why the LDL cholesterol number, especially in the case after fish oil and triglyceride lowering, why LDL cholesterol number isn't as important as maybe knowing how many particles or the size.
And finally, there's the homocysteine hypothesis, where B vitamins recently, according to some cardiologists, proved worthless in terms of prevention. What say ye?
So I've done a lot of work on the homocysteine. It doesn't homocysteine or elevated hyperhomocysteinemia is clearly a risk factor for not only heart disease but for Alzheimer's, for dementia, for fractures, for stroke, and their epidemiology on this is really good. The question is reducing homocysteine effective? And I would say if you really look in at the data that suggests that giving B vitamins, for instance, which does reduce homocysteine levels, typically folates, either methylfolate or folic acid, B6 and B12, you will reduce homocysteine by, you know, sometimes 25 to 40%, depending on the dose and where you started from. But you, like you said, there are some clinical trials that showed that when they did that, even though they reduced homocysteine, they didn't have any change on events. I can tell you that those studies and those patients had a what we call a polypharmacy of statins, beta blockers, aspirin, and in some cases blood thinners and a number of other drugs. And then on top of that, they threw a modest amount of B vitamins and asked, well, why statistically was there no benefit? In fact, there was benefit in the reduction of stroke risk, which was statistically significant, and there was a trend in many of those studies that never reached statistical significance that was in the positive realm for the vitamins. And so I think that we misunderstand homocysteine. It's more of a marker of the initiator of endothelial damage. So if you can imagine, it's sort of like I tell people, it's like the match that starts the fire. If there's a raging forest fire and you could say, yes, it was the match that caused this, well, taking the match away when the fire is going is not going to cause the fire to go away, because what's happening after the homocysteine has damaged the endothelial lining, other things, inflammation and oxidized LDL cholesterol and the whole process, homocysteine is not the mediator any longer. But if you reduce homocysteine, it then can reduce the chance of another lesion. That's why I think we see it as a reduction in stroke risk, because the time between the lesion in the brain versus an event is much shorter than the lesion in an arterial artery or a coronary artery and the event, meaning it takes much longer for that to happen. And so homocysteine, I think, is more proximate to a stroke event than it is to a myocardial infarction, which is typically the hard end point that they use for that. So I think we're missing the point on homocysteine, and so I still recommend that clinicians measure it. I still think they should, especially when it's above 11 or 12, they should certainly start looking at modifying that and bringing it down. And, you know, I think it's certainly a good marker to look at, and probably even more so for Alzheimer's and stroke and perhaps even osteoporosis than maybe even a hard endpoint for cardiovascular disease.
And I heartily agree with you on that homocysteine subject, because we, in spite of some of the negative studies, we still look out for it. We still attempt to lower it. And I think we're doing our patients a lot of good. Okay, great stuff. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine take-home message? Where can people get more information about this stuff?
Well, you can go online to the pointinstitute.org website. Right now, I'm in the midst of, you'd mentioned a couple of books that we've written in the past and are on the website. I'm not done yet with the cardiometabolic book, so I wish I could tell them they can go on right now, but they can't. So if they'll, maybe I'll come back in 6 or 8 months when I'm done with that, and I can give them. But all the things that we talked about, there's going to be monographs that will list out all the evidence-based data, what is the research, what are the mechanisms involved. Obviously, it's going to be written more for the healthcare professional to help them understand that, so they can make good decisions about, you know, where is the evidence lie for deciding, you know, which ingredient they should choose, and helping them and their patient decide the best way to reduce risk in the long term.
Okay. And while you're modest about this, you also are research and scientific director for Orthomolecular Products, which is a great line of products for patients, and you can access those products via doctor's offices and also via drhoffman.com. Specifically, berberine is available as a product called CM Core. It's a combination product, great product. We use it for blood sugar. We use it for cardiovascular prevention as well because it affects lipids. And, of course, the new bergamot BPF product. Is that the correct name?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Tom Williams.
I appreciate it, and I'm always enjoy talking with you.
Yeah, it's always great. Nice talking to you. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.